Welcome back to the Layman's Law School. We're two Southern gentleman lawyers, in this case, three Southern gentleman lawyers, try to demystify the law. We talk about the issues of the day and try to answer the public's questions about some of the most pressing legal issues that are in the news. Today is a difficult episode. We're going to be talking about the Uvalde shooting and the police's actual responsibility and duty to the children and whether or not they can be held civilly liable. And to help me with that today, I have my usual co-host, Reed Sanders. And guest today is Sean Merzlach, one of my partners.
Special guest.
A special guest, of course.
I had to put, gentleman.
You have to put special in there. Sean has a unique perspective on this, having been former law enforcement, and so he's going to give us a perspective of what the police are kind of going through when they're thinking about at that time, as well as comment on some of the legal issues. So it is Friday.
It is Friday.
And we do this every time.
Happy Friday.
And with the caveat, this is a touchy subject.
Right.
We'll be a little less light than normal.
Yeah.
But, you know, happy Friday, gentlemen. And I will start with offering y'all a nice, chilled, classic. I mean, it's a classic. I mean, it truly...
It says quite American.
I mean, when you think of America, this has got to be up there. Red, white, and blue.
Fourth of July.
Right around the corner. You pop
for
it.
For the ASMR people.
Yeah. And it's got it's a little hoppy, Sean. Be careful. I don't know if you've had these before.
All right.
Chase loves it.
Excellent.
It's a good year.
Excellent.
It's a good year.
All right. Given our topic today, I thought that we needed something a little bit more stiff than a Bud Light. And so
gotcha.
I brought Johnny Walker Black Label, Accept No Substitute. It is one of the finest scotches in the world. It's one of the favorites of one of my favorite writers and political activists.
Well, you know Reed and I, we're not going to turn anything down.
Yeah. I mean,
it's Christopher Hitchens. I disagree with a lot of his politics and points of view, but he had a quip. He was quick with a quip. So, gentlemen, before we start,
cheers. Excellent.
Smoother than the Bud Light.
Probably not. Well, I mean, maybe this one. This is not the 97. So
okay. So today, everybody's heard about the Uvalde shooting, and we're going to be tackling the question, among other things, but the main question, can the police be held legally responsible for not going into the school to help these kids? For those of you that you don't know, in May 24, 2022, a young man fatally shot 19 students and two teachers at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas. He had purchased just a couple weeks earlier, I think, a AR-15 style rifle. It's not 100% relevant to what we're talking about today, but the problem is that the police showed up and they waited 78 minutes while gunshots were going off in the school before they actually went in and I think it was an off-duty Border Patrol agent that actually commandeered a shotgun from a barbershop he was in and actually went in and, took care of the threat. Now, immediately, everybody's gut feeling is what the police did was not right. Sean, you've had a lot of training and experience. When you read about what occurred there and the police sort of and how they conducted themselves, what were your sort of first thoughts being a former police officer?
Immediately, I just thought backwards. Mm-hmm. Going back, I started in law enforcement in 1998, right before Columbine.
Right.
Which was one of the first most prevalent school shooting type things. And before then, the training was always the same for almost all police officers. Bad incident happens, no matter what it is. You show up, you surround the place, contain the scene, call for backup, and then figure out a plan.
Mm-hmm.
When Columbine happened, that's when all law enforcement training changed because they realized in an active shooter scenario, the most immediate need is for law enforcement to get to that threat and engage it, neutralize it, and then begin helping people. You can't sit around and let people with gunshot wounds to the chest sit in a building for, an hour and a half. And the longer that person is in there, actively engaged in shooting.
If you have a situation where it's like a hostage situation, then there's a training. Is that different? Where you have, okay, there's no, you know, he has a gun and there's a problem, but there's no gunshots been fired yet. Would you still go back to the old way, I guess, to say, is to create a plan and go in? Or does that change when you, when you know what I mean?
It's definitely different, and it's sometimes hard to differentiate in cases like this. When is the active shooter thing happening versus when has the person stopped? But in most cases that we see, when law enforcement immediately responds, when that person is engaged, the person is either neutralized by law enforcement or a lot of times neutralizes themselves.
Right, yeah.
And every minute that you stop that person from being involved in something might have saved, you know, someone's life. In a hostage-type situation, yes, it is more of a let's try and establish communication, negotiate with this person, everything. In a school-type incident, though, you're still going to want to go into that school and eliminate the people that aren't involved.
Right.
If a guy's holed up in a classroom with 25 kids and a teacher, let's get in there, get to the closest point we can, and then eliminate everybody else that is in there.
Sure.
Right. And we talk about it. We've talked about it a couple of times on the podcast. We are civil lawyers, okay? And so when we look to sue somebody, one of the things we do when we see facts, a set of facts, is we look for duty. In other words, do you have a duty to do a particular thing or to refrain from doing a particular thing? For example, refraining from drinking while you're driving down the road. Or if you have a duty to monitor somebody while they're swimming in a swimming pool because you're the lifeguard and you fail to do that, you get drunk, fall asleep under the tree. That is your duty. And then the falling asleep under the tree, that is the breach. We look for a breach of that duty. What you were just talking about, Sean, was an analysis of kind of maybe some of the breaches of their training that they may have had. If they recognize they had an active shooter situation, their training, from what you're telling me, is that modern police training is to actually engage the shooter at that time.
It's rapid and immediate deployment. You get two or three officers there as soon as you feel comfortable. You know, the training is actually, you know, normally like five. But, you know, different people are different. Yeah. If two or three people get there and they're guys that I feel comfortable with, we're going in.
Right.
You know, the sooner the better. If you can save, you know, one life, it's well worth it. What we have to think about, though, is training. Does that create a legal duty? There's a lot of duties. You might have a moral duty to do something. You might have an ethical duty to do something.
Sure.
Those aren't the duties that get us to where someone has a legal duty necessarily.
And my dad always used to say, and I stand by it too, is that the legal duty is the minimum. The legal duty is the minimum standard. Right. It's not ethical duty. Mm-hmm. It's not the other duties that you're talking about, Sean. The legal duty is the lowest standard there is. So, you know, there's outrage everywhere, but that doesn't mean that there are legal consequences. Like I said, you being a former officer, you would have gone in. But just because these guys didn't might not be a legal duty. It might be an ethical duty.
And it's just like the going back to the lifeguard you mentioned, you know, let's say there's no lifeguard involved and say I'm an Olympic swimmer and I'm at Clark's Hill Lake and I see a, you know, 14-year-old child out there struggling, drowning. Is there a legal duty for me to go save him? Absolutely not.
No.
But do I have a moral obligation? I think so. Do I have a, you know, an ethical obligation to use my special skills and talents to save this person? Absolutely.
Yeah. And that's part of the analysis we have to do. You have to remember part of our job, you know, we want the people that didn't, you know, live up to their moral duty, their the duties that are required of their job to in some way pay or to be held responsible for sort of what happened here. And that hits us in our gut. But what we do as lawyers is we actually look at the law, look at the statutes, look at the case law that's already been handed down about these issues, and we give a cold reading of the law. And one of the things we have to analyze here, or all the things we have to analyze, are duty. Is there a duty? Did they breach it? Did that breach cause damages?
Right.
And are there damages? We have damage. We have dead kids, dead.
Absolutely.
Dead, you know, we have a breach here because these guys should have gone in according to their police training, most likely. Okay. And then causation. Could they have saved two or three kids, five kids, six kids, had they gone in right away?
Right.
Probably. The issue in this case is going to be duty.
Sure.
This is not something that's new.
And another part of that, Chase, is that, and to for the people at home, when you're talking about us being civil lawyers, obviously, without question, the most fault is the shooter. I mean, that's just the way it is.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. But whether in all these cases, whether the shooter lives or dies, that shooter's not going to have any money to help the families for their loss.
That's right.
So you have to find an avenue where there is available funds to pay for the damage.
Right.
And that's what we're talking about here.
Right.
That, the shooter is the number one person who's at fault.
Awesome.
Now, are there other duties that should have stopped that shooter?
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's why we're talking about the liability of the police here. They did have a moral and ethical responsibility. If you have a moral and ethical responsibility associated with your professional job, it is very easy, or not easy, it is easier to convince a jury to hold those people responsible when they didn't act in a way that helped them. But when
if you can get to the jury.
That's right. You have to get to the jury, because what you have to do a lot of times before that is actually present a portion of the case to the judge and actually show that these police officers had a duty. You guys have reviewed some of the case law associated with it, and what did the case law kind of play out with what your gut sort of tells you?
I'll start. I mean, it played out with what my gut told me in regards to me being a lawyer for a good bit of time.
Exactly. Exactly. Like, does it smell right? Not necessarily. No. Based on my knowledge, training, and experience, I think it's the way that it would have went.
Yeah.
You know, legally.
Legally. Yeah. I don't like it.
Right.
I don't. Yeah. But I thought that that's how it would go.
Right.
And so in Chase, you can elaborate more, but essentially, it reminds me, to add some levity to the show. It reminds me of the final episode or final couple of episodes of Seinfeld, and I don't know if y'all know that, but they were laughing at somebody getting robbed on the street, and there was a new law in that town, the make believe town, that said, you know, if you don't act, then you have a duty, and they got arrested because they didn't help. They were sitting there laughing and taking watching. Well, that's not a real law.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I kind of felt like that in with the police officers, in that there's not really a legal duty to go.
Right.
And so now you may have personal repercussions on a specific officer or something that didn't do something. He may get fired because he didn't do what he was supposed to do.
Sure.
But the party he was supposed to save ethically doesn't really have a legal right, in my opinion, to come after that officer.
Right. And it's unfortunate, but that's how the case law has borne out over the years. And the courts are, of course, balancing interest here. They're balancing interest in having effective law enforcement and having solvent cities. I mean, if you try to quantify the value of the loss of these children, that city would no longer exist as far as its budget goes if you were able to.
Essentially what you're saying, Chase, is if they sued and the city had to pay, they're going to have to pay millions, close to billions of dollars, and the town goes bankrupt.
That's right. And so when the courts looked at cases like this over the years, the case where this kind of analysis really sort of starts is DeShaney versus Winnebago County Department of Social Services from 1982. This was a case where a mother, a little boy, 4-year-old boy, was in the custody of his father. And and the mother felt that he was being abused. She reported it to social services. They monitored him for over a year. They had 20 plus visits. During that 1 year, he went to the ER twice with injuries. Mm-hmm. They noted bruises. The social services said that he should be removed from the father because she felt like the child was in danger. And he eventually put the boy in a coma. And the boy has been institutionalized ever since. Oof. And so she actually brought a lawsuit against Winnebago County, alleging that they had deprived him of liberty, his liberty interest and in bodily integrity, his life, liberty, and property without due process.
So Chase,
the 14th Amendment.
Right. So I think we need to go into a little bit of that. So what is due process? How do you explain that?
So
what does that mean for the general, for the layman, you know, as we say?
So let's just say, for instance, like if we're talking about there's something called eminent domain. That's where if the city has a need to take your land, okay, for to build a road, to build whatever it is, they can come in and do that. But you have to have a hearing on it. And they have to show good cause and economic need, the need for the community in order to do it. So you have to have some sort of form before a state actor in the United States can come in and take anything from you, whether it be property, whether it be life, or whether it be your actual liberty.
Right.
And as we talked about before, some of the other goes
with going to jail and all that. That's all that stuff is. If you're wrongly accused, not necessarily, but if an officer doesn't have any right and essentially kidnaps you, that's a due process violation.
Right. And we talked about it before about how the corporate, when we were talking about in our past episode about abortion, that 14th Amendment and the court reads into the word liberty. What does liberty mean in the American tradition and history? And one of the things that they have actually recognized is this liberty interest in bodily integrity. So if you're injured as a result of some sort of conduct without a hearing of a police officer, okay, then you can have a 14th Amendment, this is a 1983 action, against the state.
But pretty much all, of those with police officers are actions that they took, not inactions.
That's right.
And
that's
so
right.
That's where we.
It's usually a not a neglect of duty, but a
overreaching or
a physical type thing that the police officer purposely did.
Right.
Not just the police officer failed to do anything.
Right.
And I think it's so. What bothers me the most is how they differentiate between, well, yes, the police have an absolute legal duty to protect the public as a whole, but they have no legal duty to protect you individually.
Yeah. So you have a duty to the whole and not a duty to the individual. Mm-hmm. And so that is where, the gray area starts to happen in the
splitting
law.
Splitting hairs.
Right. I mean, what is the body versus the individual. It is a school shooting where you have 30 people at harm. Mm-hmm. Is that the body or is that the individual? I mean, that's kind of the fight that's going to continue to happen, I think.
Yeah.
Is so the only duty the officer has is to the entirety, the society, right? So not the individual. Mm-hmm. So what does that mean? That's where the fight's going to come. And like, is the Las Vegas shooting when it was a concert, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000. What's the number that is going to make it where it's, okay, now it's societal, not individual.
Not individual.
And the courts haven't had that question yet, at least that I know of, but it's coming.
It's because they're going to look at every single individual that was injured and say,
that's where your damage comes from.
He didn't have a legal duty to protect this particular individual.
Sure.
Case by case.
Right. Know. And that's what, so me and Chase were talking earlier, these things are so, these types of situations where when you have government entities being sued for the duty or lack of duty, all that, it is so case specific. There's not a, straight line answer.
And they've carved out a few, but I mean, that's one of them being what we talked about, like purposeful conduct that is a civil rights violation by police. Sure. And the other one being when they've already taken control of somebody.
Right, then they have a duty to...
Corrections departments of the government that have a prisoner in custody, things like that.
Right.
Yeah, and that issue of custody is one of the sort of novel legal theories that's come up in some of these other cases involving mass shootings with schools. And in the, and the court, when they look at Sandy Hook, the Parkland shootings and stuff like that, it's been argued that because you're mandated to go to school, because they lock the building down, and they're supposed to have locks on the doors, that type of thing, that your freedom is limited. And that's really one of the measures is whether or not you're under the custody of the state. But the court has really strayed away from expanding the definition of being in custody, especially to just like, hey, you're locked in the school. Mm-hmm. They got a perimeter around it. It is when you are incarcerated, when you're actually arrested. What was the case in Los Angeles where they pulled him over on the side of the street and beat him? It was on the news.
Rodney King.
That's an example of when they actually, actually had him in custody and then actually purposefully did things to harm him.
Right.
Those are both of the exceptions. So, there are two main exceptions to it. The first being that when you're in the custody, they have to take reasonable steps in order to secure your safety. Okay. And then after that, the only time, the other time they can be held responsible is when they purposefully actually engage and cause harm.
And so this one, we're dealing with, the purposeful harm is, I don't think is even close to there. Yeah, it's not an issue. But the only thing that I've ever read or seen where it imposes a duty with a school type situation is the crossing guard example, where the crossing guard is now in control of your child, and they are getting them across the street, right? And if the crossing guard is playing on his phone or her phone, and then the kid gets hit, then there is a duty for that crossing guard.
Right, because there's a special relationship.
There's a special relationship. But it has not crossed into the school system yet, into, hey, I have to send my kids to school. If I don't, as a parent, I go to jail, and I have to, they have to be there. That, you know, to me as a father, that is, it should be under the due process. But me as a lawyer, it is not.
Sure. And that's what is so difficult for, obviously, you know, certainly the layman, the average person to think of is that if I don't send my children to school, I get arrested.
Right.
There's a legal duty to send my children to school.
Sure.
And when they get there, they're in the custody and control of the school.
Right.
But for these purposes, they're not.
Right.
Take it a step further. Once a critical incident like this happens at a school, what are all the schools taught now? They have a lockdown procedure.
Right.
All of the, you know, an alarm is rung. All of the teachers lock the doors. They put, you know, particular colored things on the windows so that law enforcement can know that this room is okay, and that immediate response team can bypass that room.
Right.
And if, when you get up in age, let's say you're 13 years old and in middle school, and you're hearing gunshots in the school and you want to run.
Right.
And a teacher locks the door and says, you can't run. You are confined to this space.
Right.
It's hard for me to fathom how you can't say that a state actor hasn't placed you in
because
custody.
Because the teacher also is an employee of the state.
Sure.
And I'll give you an example, Sean. Let's say, you know, I have two boys. Let's say, you know, as they get older, this coming year they'll be in the same school. And let's say school gets into lockdown, there's an active shooter, and my oldest says, I'm going to find my little brother. Screw y'all. And they say, no, you can't.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
To me, that is a due process violation.
Restricting your liberty.
I mean, you are. And so that's why I say these things are so fact specific in that sooner or later, there is going to be a fact that creates that due process duty for the school. I don't know what that is, but there is going to come a time because it's getting more. I remember when I was in school, people could come in and out. It wasn't locked doors. It was nothing. So now you're having it. You can't leave, you can't come in, you can't. So there's going to be a point of the reaction to these things to lock schools down, make them safer, that creates a violation of your due process. It has to.
And then we take it a step further. Let's not focus the conduct on what happened with the students. Let's talk about, you know, how the parents who were showing up at Uvalde during this more than an hour long active shooting scenario and were refrained by law enforcement, state actors from interfering.
Yep.
And I think that's, I mean, from reading online and stuff, I mean, and me as a parent, I'm going in, man. Yep. I'm going in.
Yeah.
And if you try, I mean, I'm going to get arrested. That's fine. I don't care. I'm going in. And that to me is I saw the biggest outrage, and that upset me the most, to be honest. If I was a parent and they were tackling me, putting me in handcuffs, and I couldn't go to get my child,
you're in custody.
Then that's a due process violation, in my opinion.
Yeah, and it's funny that you mentioned all this, just because, we have what they call the majority opinion in the Supreme Court. The majority opinion in DeShaney, held that the police didn't have any sort of duty. All right. Well, there's always what they call a dissent. These are the people that lost out, the judges that didn't win.
Yeah.
Right. But what you end up finding, though, a lot of times is that the dissent 10 years ago becomes the law in the future.
And the dissent can also tell you about certain facts that didn't happen in the case, but that could happen that would result in the law changing.
Right. And so one of the dissenters in that DeShaney case, they were, I think it was, Justice Brennan, he stated that if the state had never intervened, if they had not come in and started monitoring that child and given the mother the...
And you're talking about the 20 visits from the social services, so that case.
Right, exactly, that case, where the mother had reported that the young boy was being abused, and then they visited him 20 times, and they were, you know, taking steps to try and, I guess, get him out of there. He's saying that had the state never intervened, that his family would have intervened and got him out of there, right? And that by handing that duty over to the police, right, that the police were, or the social worker was assuming responsibility for making sure that kid was safe, and a responsibility that the mother would have had if she knew about abuse and that her child was being beat by the father. She had a duty and a responsibility to report that, to go and get the child away from the father.
Right.
Okay. And in this situation, because of the special relationship, you know, and...
Well, and that was the only avenue that really the mother had.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, other than self-help, which would be, you know, go and snatch your child
and
out
then
of...
You get, then you get arrested
for kidnapping, you know, things like that, or interference with child custody.
Right.
You rely on the government for certain things.
And we talked about this at the beginning of this, and it just hit me that with the police not going in to Uvalde is an inaction, but the police stopping the parents is an action.
That is,
so because, I think that there is a much higher chance that the parents have a claim that will surpass summary judgment. Summary judgment is what Chase was talking about, where you can't even get your case to the jury. The judge says by law, not by facts, but by law, you don't have a right to pursue this case. But right. I think with the duty will have for the parents to protect their children, and the police officers are interfering with that duty and trying to stop them, I think that may get past summary judgment. It's still going to be a stretch, but I see that having a more a higher likelihood of success than the children saying they were under the custody.
Right.
What, do y'all agree? Disagree?
I agree with that.
I agree, but I think then you have to go a little bit further in the analysis of if a police officer does something inappropriate to me, we have a duty that's been violated, and I may have damages myself.
Right.
And we have to think about, is there any causation that we can show that for the child's death?
Sure.
Not just that, my liberty was restricted by a police officer.
Sure.
Those are my damages.
Well, I think
not is there a causal relationship that if I hadn't been restricted, I could have saved my child. That's where the stretch is legally. You can't prove, you know, we can always say it's always difficult to prove something that we have no idea what could have happened.
Yeah.
Right.
If the police would have let you through, would you have gotten to your child in time?
Sure.
It's all spectacle.
And that's the damages part. And that's, you know, something we're going to talk about too. But I think that purely summary judgment type situations are getting struck down by a judge. I think that it has a better chance to get past it.
Absolutely.
Now, then, as we'll talk about,
that's when cases settle.
Yeah. Then you have to talk about damages and causation.
Mm-hmm.
And Chase, we were talking before about the case that they gave a couple of avenues, but then they said, hey, you're still going to have causation. Explain that a little bit.
Sure. Yeah. So this isn't the first time, of course. There's been some mass shooting in the United States, unfortunately. And lawyers have come up with some sort of novel ways in which to actually recover for the families. And
that's what we do.
Yes, that's right. That's right. So we look at anybody that can pay, that might be responsible, that the law will allow us to hold responsible for these situations. And right now, one of the more successful ways in which people have been reimbursed or their damages have been paid is through suing manufacturers of firearms.
Right.
Okay. There is a significant level of protection for manufacturers. There's only about 6 exceptions to the rule, but there's a protection.
And only about 1 or 2 of those actually are
matter. Yeah. But it's a 2005 Protection of Lawful Commerce Arms Act. And basically it says you can't sue the manufacturer for crimes committed with the actual product that they get, right? But the exception,
and this is a federal law across the entire United States.
Exactly, right? Exactly. And but one of the exceptions is if they break a federal or state law as it relates to the sale or the marketing of that gun or our product, then they are, the courts have ruled that they are actually subject to being sued. Now, that is
an exception to a law that prevents them from being sued, essentially. Right.
So what they had a duty to do was obey by the state or federal regulations that relate to the sale or the marketing of that gun. They had a duty. That is something that the state, the federal government recognizes, okay?
And generally, not to cut you off, but generally the sale's not going to be a part of it. No. I mean,
it's most often, there's a Soto versus Bushmaster. And then there's a lawsuit versus Remington Arms that relates, I think, to the Sandy Hook shooting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and it relates to the marketing of their particular gun. Now, they had a summary judgment motion to determine whether or not they could be sued based on the immunities given by this particular act. And the court said, nope, there is a state law that prohibits you from having immoral, irresponsible marketing related to your gun. And so what was going to happen is a jury was going to get to see all these dead children, see Remington, see Bushmaster on the other side, multi-million dollar corporations selling, you know, assault rifles. And if there is,
opening the checkbook,
a human being with a heartbeat, right, they're not going to care about a corporation. Right. And they knew that.
Right.
Now, what the problem is that you would have to show that the guy in Parkland saw the advertising, saw the marketing, and that helped cause him to shoot the person. That was, the court said it would be a Herculean effort to show causation. But you have to have them all. You have to have duty. You have to have breach. You have to have causation.
And when you think about damages. That, these things that where the creativity in being a lawyer usually comes down to using the subjectivity of a law.
Sure.
Like Reed said, the violation of a state or federal law relating to the sale of a firearm, that's pretty objective. You can look at it and determine whether or not they did it or not. And these multi-billion dollar corporate gun manufacturers are obeying the laws.
They've done the research on that.
These aren't, you know, gun runners, you know.
Yeah.
But the subjective thing is, does it relate to the marketing or advertising? And did they do something wrong? And then you go to a very subjective law of it's illegal to do an immoral type marketing ad. And that's where when you get your foot in.
What's the old law joke about was pornographic? You know, it's in the
purient interest.
Yeah, it said
when you know it, you see it.
Yeah, when you know you see it. That's it. That's it. Thank you.
I can't give a good definition.
I can't give a definition. You know it, you see it. And that was in the report there. So that's kind of like that. You know.
Well, and often that's how the law works. Yep. When a issue is borderline,
right,
and a judge is making a legal decision.
Yep.
Yeah.
And the judge has the option to go one way or another. A lot of times, they're going to side with the party that's in the least favorable position, the most sympathetic party.
Yeah, yeah.
You mentioned it, but you kind of glossed over it. Is the summary judgment, first of all, you look at the facts. It's not a trial. You look at the facts most in favor of the non-moving party. So what that essentially means is if you're a plaintiff and they file a summary judgment motion against you, then if there's facts in dispute, it doesn't matter that they have more evidence or not, that you look at the facts that are, you always take them in favor of the person who's going to have summary judgment ruled against them. And so that's the first part. The second part is you are talking about how it's going to be tough to, a Herculean effort to show that the causation. Legally, that is 100% true.
True.
Factually, not so much, because the jury is going to be told you cannot. It has to be shown that this caused this. It has to be done. The judge is going to tell them you cannot do it,
and the jury is going to say,
"I don't care."
That's right.
I don't care, and they're just going to award the money, and that's why these cases settle. Because if they get past summary judgment, mm-hmm. the big gun owners, the big money, mm-hmm. they know that they're not a sympathetic defendant, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. they're going to get hammered.
That's right. And that legal sort of theory, doctrine, idea, whatever, of the jury just doing whatever the hell the jury wants is called jury nullification. Mm-hmm. So they can be told what the law is all day long, and then they can do exactly
yep.
whatever they want. The only other sort of avenue that has arisen for situations like this is when the state already actually knew about it.
Sure.
In the Parkland shootings, there were facts that basically the FBI had gotten tips 2 or 3 weeks before from 2 separate people stating the person had guns, mm-hmm. and the person was affiliated or interested in ISIS, was talking about shooting and killing a bunch of people, that he was going to go to a school and actually do it. They told him what his name was. He had recently purchased guns or was planning to purchase guns.
Right.
That he was mutilating small animals. And the FBI basically just never followed up on it. And in that particular case, I think the federal government just settled 40 separate civil lawsuits for about $127 million. And right. so at the end of the day, the idea is that human beings that suffer terrible, great loss and went at the hands of either some failure of the state or mm-hmm. of an individual, in order to have a civil society where you can go on with your life and not have people having these vendettas against each other, is to have a forum where your complaint can be heard, number one, and number two, that you get some level or measure of justice. And it is weird to talk about money when it comes to the value of a child's life or a human being's life.
Well, I mean, it is.
But it is the only thing we have. It's the only thing we have. I mean, all of us exchange our time for money.
Yep.
Right? And that's exchanging life for money. So if you lose life,
There's no way. We talk to clients all the time, Sean mm-hmm. and Chase, I mean, that suffer injuries, horrific mm-hmm. injuries, and we do a ton of wrongful deaths. And the first thing I always tell them is, there's nothing that I can do that's going to mm-hmm. fix it. I can't bring Correct. This child back. I can't fix your arm. I can't, fix a missing leg. Mm-hmm. The only thing that we can do in our society is mm-hmm. to have a monetary result from this action, and that is to try to put a number on it and help your life way.
And that's the only way, not necessarily with governments, but with other, is to change the behavior of people right. or mm-hmm. corporations right. is to punish them in that way.
Yep.
Right. It doesn't necessarily work as well for governments because, sure. and that's yeah. why qualified immunity is kind of there, because we entrust that the government is working mm-hmm. on our behalf in our best interest, and things like that. But mm-hmm. when a terrible
assumption on our yeah. part, but
that's the assumption of that's qualified immunity. I know. Necessarily my assumption.
Right. Right. The law, the same people who are getting immunity made the law. So that tells you a little something.
Correct. but when you talk about, people or businesses, mm-hmm. small businesses or corporations, mm-hmm. if they're doing something wrong mm-hmm. And there's nothing that is done about it, mm-hmm. The only way to change and correct that behavior is mm-hmm. for, a lawsuit yeah. to happen mm-hmm. and them to have to pay
right.
or their insurance company to mm-hmm. have to pay and then increase their insurance rates. Yep. And they mm-hmm. realize, I shouldn't be doing that because now it's costing me money.
Yep. Yep. Yep.
And it's a balance, and people don't understand. They look at, especially plaintiff attorneys as trying to chase money and all this stuff, but it really, if you look around our world, the mm-hmm. the things that are safe are because of plaintiff attorneys.
Mm-hmm.
It's because that every company wants to, and including law firms, including mm-hmm. podcast centers and all mm-hmm. this other mm-hmm. want to cut costs as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
But when you get that fine line of cutting cost and then danger to people,
mm-hmm.
that's where plaintiff lawyers have to come in and go, hey, mm-hmm. yeah, I know you want to cut costs and make money, but this thing cost $5 and you just cost this person $1 million. The only other thing I really wanted to see y'all's opinion on the Uvalde situation with the police is we've dealt with the fireman rule.
Mm-hmm.
And the fireman That's rule right. is essentially a first responder cannot recover
mm-hmm.
If they're injured doing right. what they're paid to do.
Yeah.
Right? So a police officer goes somewhere. He's called for a burglary,
mm-hmm.
and he goes in and gets shot by the guy right. who's burglarizing.
Yeah, that's right. Burglary.
Burglaring.
Yeah.
Burglaring.
Yeah,
yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah, whatever.
A person can get burgled.
Burgled, yes. This person was being burgled, and he got shot. So, the police officer can't recover because the courts have consistently said That's what you're paid to do. We're paying you to assume this danger.
Right.
So you
which is a harsh rule.
It's a very harsh rule.
We're talking about public safety that's not getting paid hardly anything.
I hate the rule. I hate it. I don't think it should be a rule. I think that the first responders should be able to recover. Right. I truly do. But the law is they can't.
Right.
So use the inverse of that. Mm-hmm. If they're being paid to do it,
doesn't
that create a duty?
Duty to do it.
Doesn't that create a duty to act? It's just a, you know, it's a question. I don't know the answer
splitting
to it.
Splitting hairs. That is, just like, they have a duty to everybody, but they don't have a duty to you, and they don't have a duty to you.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
It's I don't know how they justify it.
Well, Reed, I can't wait to see you argue that before the Supreme Court.
Well, if I have to argue it in front of the Supreme Court, I'm going to lose because it's the government, and they want to keep their money.
That's not true.
That is true.
You work for the Hawk Law
Group. I mean, I might win, but they're going to keep the government's going to keep their money. If I know anything about the government, they're going to keep their money.
We shall see. Well, I want to thank everybody for watching. I hope you liked our take on Uvalde, and you got a little bit of information that was useful to you. If you did like it, like, subscribe. You can go see some of our older episodes on the new abortion decision that just happened in the Supreme Court. Stay tuned for next week. Sean's going to be back with us. We're going to be talking about the Second Amendment and some cases that are actually going to be decided in late June. That may affect your gun rights here in Georgia and South Carolina.
Do you think we need to tell them the truth? What the truth about why we brought Sean on?
Yeah.
Pure sex appeal.
Pure sexual charisma.
Correct. I told them that they were wanted to do this podcast. Mm-hmm. I said, well, I've got a lot of good information to give, but I've got a face for the screen.
Right.
Once I found out that it's actually videotaped,
you're in.
I was in. Yeah. I know that viewership is going to go through the roof now.
Skyrocket.
Thank you all for watching all the BS. We'll see you next time.